education, computation, and the physical world. Leave it at that. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. Good to be here. So, I guess as many of you know, my background is in computer science, not in physics. So I thought I would start with the computer science picture of reality, or at any rate, it was my picture of reality for quite a while. So what is this picture? Well, first of all, you know, obviously things are, you know, discrete rather than continuous at a small enough scale. I don't need any quantum graphic theory to tell me that. At this small scale, say the Planck scale, you know, there are some very, very simple local rules acting, and they produce extremely complex behavior at a large scale. Now, the specific form of those rules, maybe it's a somewhat interesting question, but we believe that sort of any sufficiently complex set of rules is going to be able to simulate, you know, any other such rules, right? So, I mean, some people like Java, some people like C, but in terms of their expressive power in a formal sense, they're equivalent. If we really want to get a deep understanding of the world, it seems like, you know, maybe we should just black box what the actual rules are, and say, all right, you know, any sufficiently complex set of rules is about as good as any other. So what happened to this? Well, then I learned a little bit about quantum mechanics. And so quantum computing challenges this picture. It's precisely because I took what's called the extended Church-Turing thesis, or the thesis that sort of any physically reasonable model of computation is equivalent to what you can do on an ordinary classical Turing machine. I was interested in quantum computing. I mean, this is why I care about it. Not because, you know, I've ever stayed up at night, you know, hungering for the factors of any 600-digit integer. Okay, but because, you know, it implies a very, very different picture of what sort of computational resources are present in nature in some sense. You know, I think that this is why everyone should care about it, whether or not quantum factoring machines are ever built. All right, so plan of the talk, I'll give a little bit of background for physicists about the model of quantum computation and so on. And then in the first part of the talk, I'm going to talk about limitations of quantum computers. This will be my lower bound extravaganza. Supposing we had a quantum computer, what could we do with it? And show that quantum computers would actually be subject to very serious limitations for sort of a wide variety of problems. The second part of the talk, I'll talk about the actual model and its what is its relationship to physical reality? What are the alternatives to this model? Is this sort of too powerful a model to computation to really be plausible, or could there be an even more powerful model of computation that would be compatible with the laws of physics? All right. So background. All right. So here's just a little sketch of the universe. At least the classical universe. So the class of efficiently solvable problems we identify as P. This is formally the class of problems that you could solve using a classical computer in time that increases only polynomially in the size of the problem instance. Meaning, you know, as the sort of the number of bits that you would need to specify the problem instance raised to some fixed power. So, for example, if I give you a graph and ask whether it's connected or not, well, you can solve that in an amount of time that increases as the number of vertices squared. Right? NP, non-deterministic polynomial time, well, that's the class of problems where if the answer is yes, then you might not be able to find that out efficiently on your own, but if you have an omniscient prover around, then the prover can hand you some proof that lets you verify in a polynomial amount of time, indeed the answer is yes. So, you know, for example, factoring might be very hard, but if someone gives you prime factors of a number, you can verify, you know, indeed they are correct. Now, a problem is called NP hard if it's at least as hard as any NP problem, you know, in the formal sense that sort of, you know, you can convert any instance of an NP problem efficiently into an instance of that NP hard problem. Okay, and then we call a problem NP complete if it's both NP hard and an NP. So the NP complete problems are the maximal or the hardest problems in NP. And I've given a bunch of examples. I've given a graph, is there a Hamilton cycle? Or can you color each vertex with one of three colors so that every two adjacent vertices have a different color? All right, these are examples of NP complete problems. Okay, so that's just a... orient you a little. Okay, so now what's the idea of quantum computing? Well, I guess just a sort of it's an extremely simple idea. It's just if you have a quantum state of n qubits since I'm at perimeter n spin 1/2 particles, you can describe such a state by a vector. To describe such a state, you need a vector of 2 to the n complex numbers. This is a tremendous amount of information. I mean, if we think about just like a 1,000 particles in some general quantum state, you know, it would seem like nature sort of off to the side somewhere is having to scribble down or you know, keep track of these 2 to the 1,000 numbers. And so the goal of quantum computing is simply to exploit the exponentiality, which is inherent in the laws of physics as we currently understand them. So now another class of problems that will be playing a leading role in this talk is called BQP, stands for Bounded Error Quantum Polynomial Time. And you can just think of this as just the class of problems that's solvable efficiently on a quantum computer. So formally, it's the class of problems where there's some polynomial time quantum algorithm that always returns the right answer to your problem with probability at least 2/3, let's say. Okay? And you can make the probability of success as high as you like by running the computation several times and taking a majority answer. Okay. All right. So this is going to be my one slide history of the field. 1993, Bernstein and Mazzarani set out, you know, what are the basic quantum complexity classes, and sort of turned it into a formal model that could be studied using the tools of complexity theory. And in particular, so they defined the class BQP. They said, well, you know, however powerful it is, at any rate, it's at least as powerful as classical polynomial time. You can do something with a classical computer, you can do it with a quantum computer also. On the other hand, quantum computers are at most exponentially more powerful. Okay, so anything you can do in quantum polynomial time, you can also do with a classical computer that would have a polynomial amount of memory, right? Possibly an exponential amount of time. So we still didn't really have a concrete example of what's a problem that would be in BQP, but that we don't know to be in P. So of course, the result that really started the field is the problem of factoring integers is in BQP. This is of interest to people other than number theorists, and this is why funding in the field comes from DARPA and NSA and so forth, because factoring has applications like reading people's email. So then another important quantum algorithm that will play a role in my talk is Grover's algorithm. And this is an algorithm for sort of searching any set of n possibilities in order to find, you know, which of them is marked or which of them is correct or anything. And it only square root of n steps as opposed to having to try all of them or about half of them as you would need to do classically. So it's extremely general purpose. But on the other hand, then you can see the speed up is only quadratic as opposed to the exponential speed up of Shor's factoring algorithm. All right. So I know that would have probably bored a lot of you. So let me move on. Talk about what are the limitations of quantum computers? And in order to address this question, in order to say anything concrete about it, we have to fix a model in which we can actually prove something. Okay, and this model is called the quantum black box model, and I have a quote from Shakespeare. It's also called the Oracle model, and you know there are people who believe things against oracles, but if you know the only information you have is coming from oracles, then you don't have much choice. So let me tell you what this model is. Basically, what it is instead of counting the number of computational steps, you know, or trying to analyze that, which is you know unbelievably difficult, right? This is like the p versus np problem, right? Or trying to lower bound how many computational steps you need. So just give up on that. Just write that off from the start, and just count the number of accesses that you have to make to some oracle or to some black box. Okay, so it's easier if I just give you a concrete example of it. All right, so let's say that you have a Boolean function f that takes n bits of input and produces one bit of output, and your goal is to decide whether there is an input x such that f of x equals one. So just you know find the sort of a marked item, and you could think of this abstractly as you know it's like solving an NP-complete problem by brute force. Okay, it's like trying to solve an NP-complete problem like trying to three-color a graph. But if you didn't know anything about the structure of the problem, or if you chose to, or if you did know but you chose to throw away all of that information. Okay, and you're just doing the dumbest thing possible, saying, all right, here's a solution, you know, if it doesn't work, no. All right, here's another one, does that one work? No. Okay, and so on. So classically, of course, you know, if there are 2 to the n possible solutions, then in the worst case, you're going to have to try all of them before you find out if there's one that works. On the other hand, you know, as I mentioned, Grover's algorithm can do better than that by querying the different possibilities in quantum superposition. You can get a square root speed up, which means 2 to the n/2 queries. And then there's a very important result of Bennett, Bernstein, Broussard, and Vazirani, the publication date, but the proving of this result predated Grover's algorithm. So Grover's algorithm was actually proven to be optimal before it was discovered to exist. So they showed, you know, again, you know, if you throw away the structure of the problem, then you actually need order 2 to the n/2 queries. Okay, so a quantum computer does not give you an exponential speed up for this generic kind of search problem. It only gives you this quadratic speed up. And you could take this as providing an abstract sort of evidence that NP is not contained in BQP. Or in other words, that NP-complete problems are non-solvable in polynomial time using a quantum computer. Right? And you could say it's kind of weak evidence, but you know, this is what we have. All right, so let me just say a little bit what this model is. So at any time, I'll imagine that we've got a quantum computer, and it's in a superposition over classical basis states, each of which is of the form x comma w, where x is some location or some bit of the oracle to query, and W is some workspace that could be as long as you like and contain whatever, you know, auxiliary information that the algorithm wants to store. So that is what the state of our quantum computer will look like at any point in time. And then we stipulate that there's a special kind of transformation called a query transformation. And what it does is it takes that state, and for each x, it computes f of x, where f is the black box function we're interested in. So since a quantum computer has to be reversible, it has to be unitary, it exclusives that f into some, let's say, the initial part of the workspace. Okay, so it just, you know, it writes f of x in the workspace in some reversible way. And so we can make many such queries, but between any two of them, say we can apply any unitary matrix we like that doesn't depend on f. Okay, so we'll be trying to prove lower bounds. We'll be trying to prove that you need at least some number of queries to solve a problem with a quantum computer. So it doesn't hurt to make our algorithm more powerful, or right? Give it the benefit of the doubt. Say, between two queries, you can apply any change of basis you like that doesn't depend on the function. And then what we're interested in is how many accesses to this function do you need to solve the problem. So we'll define the complexity of the problem to be the minimum number of queries that you need, this just says, to get the right answer. Okay. In other words, for all possible oracles f, the probability when you measure the computer at the end that you read some basis state corresponding to the correct answer should be at least 2/3. Here, 2/3 is just an arbitrary constant between a half and one. Okay. And again, you could make the probability of success as large as you like by repeating the algorithm several times and then just taking a majority vote. Okay, so this is the quantum black box model. This is all kind of abstract, so let me give you a specific problem. All right, here's my problem. Find two numbers here that are the same. It's not a very hard problem. Yeah, it doesn't take very long. What I want to ask about is how long would it take in general to find 41. Okay. How long would it take in general to find two numbers that are the same? I promise you, and this is actually true, that every number appears exactly twice in this list. Okay. So classically, you know, if we're just going to sort of sample numbers at random, there's this well-known cocktail party fact or whatever called the birthday paradox, right? That if there are 23 people in a room, there's a 50% chance that two of them will have the same birthday, because what matters is the number of pairs of people, not the number of people. So you can generalize that to a year with n days. If you have a list of n numbers and each one appears twice, then you only have to sample what are square root n of the numbers before, with high probability, you find a collision, meaning two numbers that are the same. But now what about quantum mechanically? Okay, what if you could query, or if you imagine that these are all different people, well, you can go into a superposition of asking different people their birthdays, and then sort of manipulate the answers coherently and ask them again, and so on. What if you could make quantum queries to this 2-to-1 function? Well, now we've got this quadratic speed up from Grover's algorithm, and we've also got a quadratic speed up from the birthday paradox. So if we put the two together, do we get even more of a speed up? So there's a result of Broussard, Royer, and Tapp, 1997, that says, indeed we do. In this case, we can solve the problem using the cube root of n queries instead of the square root of n. And their algorithm is just basically, it just combines Grover's algorithm with the birthday paradox. I won't go into it. But then the question arises: can you do even better than that? you know, in particular, could there be a quantum algorithm that would solve this problem using only one query, or using only five, or using only log n queries, right? And can you get some exponential improvement over what you could get by brute force? You know, proving any lower bound on this problem, anything, I mean, all right, so it's pretty clear that you need at least one query. But proving, you know, any non-trivial lower bound was an open problem for 5 years. And I think, you know, it was kind of considered a benchmark for sort of, you know, do we understand, you know, quantum query complexity and, you know, and, so a number of people looked at it, and but why does anyone care about this problem other than birthdays? First of all, cryptographic hash functions. So, for cryptography, one of the most basic primitives is a hash function, like you might have some long message and then you want to compute a short signature of that message, right? And you can break this cryptographic primitive if you can find two messages that hash to the same signature, right? So this is called the problem of finding collisions in cryptographic hash functions. This is one of the most basic problems in cryptanalysis. And people actually use the analog of the birthday attack to solve this in practice. So again, if there were some algorithm, a generic quantum algorithm to solve the collision problem using, let's say, log of n queries, then this would imply that a lot of the most basic things in cryptography would just be impossible in a world with quantum computers. So that's one motivation. Another motivation comes from the graph isomorphism problem, where you're given two graphs, you want to decide if they're isomorphic. This problem is not known to be NP-complete. In fact, it's known that if it were NP-complete, all sorts of strange things would happen. So it's believed, you know, very it's believed to be sort of intermediate between P and NP-complete. One way to see what's sort of funny about this problem is that if you could solve the collision problem, then you could using, say, log of n queries, then you could solve the graph isomorphism problem in polynomial time. Why is that? Well, just, you know, so assume for simplicity that the two graphs have no non-trivial automorphisms, and just consider all n factorial possible permutations of the one graph and all n factorial possible permutations of the other. Now, considered as a set of 2n factorial graphs, well, they're all going to be different if the graphs are not isomorphic. But if they are isomorphic, then this is going to be that each graph is going to appear exactly twice in the list. Right. So if you can distinguish a one-to-one, function from a two-to-one function, or if you can find a collision if it exists, then you can find the isomorphism between the graphs. So again, if there were sort of this fast algorithm to solve the problem, it would have some of these very strange consequences. What makes proving the lower bound hard is that a quantum computer can almost find a collision in only a single query. And the way it would work is you go into a superposition of querying all of the different numbers, superposition of the form x, f of x, and then you would measure the f of x register. And now, assuming your function is 2-to-1, what will be left in the first register is, an equal superposition over two inputs that hash to the same output, right? X and y such that f of x is equal to f of y. And now, if only you could measure twice. if only you could read them both out, then you've solved the problem, right? The iteration is right there. The only problem is that, you measure and you get X or you get Y, you don't get both. But maybe there's some more clever way that you could get both by querying F multiple times and then doing something more sophisticated. All right, so what I showed is that any algorithm to solve the problem has to make at least n to the 1/5 queries. Okay, so recall that the upper bound was cube root of n, was n to the 1/3. But all right, at least you know we've shown that all right, if n is exponentially large, well, n to the 1/5 is still exponentially large. So you know, so. I was happy, but you know, people still worked on it. In particular, today we know, thanks to Yaoyan Shi, that n to the 1/3 queries are actually necessary. So that n to the 1/3 really is the correct answer. And this was also generalized to other problems and to. By Sam Kooten, Anderson Bionis there, and Gaddis Mitrogenis. All right, so we have a proof sketch. It'll be the only one to talk. So basically, the way we do it is we assume that so suppose that we have a T-query quantum algorithm that is able to solve the problem, to find collisions in 2-to-1 functions. Well, clearly, if we could use such an algorithm to distinguish 1-to-1 from 2-to-1 functions, because well, if we find a collision, the function must be 2-to-1, and you know, otherwise it's 1-to-1. Okay, now there's a lemma, a very useful lemma due to Beals, Berman, Cleave, Mosca, and DeWolf. I guess two of them are here, which says that. If there's a quantum algorithm to solve a problem making t queries, well, then there's a multilinear polynomial p of degree at most 2t, degree at most twice the number of queries. The variables of this polynomial are sort of in this case, they'll be indicator variables. That'll be like 1 if the ith number is equal to j and 0 otherwise. Right, so it'll be a polynomial of degree 2t in such indicator variables, such that the polynomial evaluates to the probability that the algorithm says the input is 2 to 1, that the input function is 2-to-1 rather than 1-to-1. The way you get such a polynomial is you just write out what the quantum algorithm is doing, right? And each time it makes a query, that increases the degree of the polynomial by 1. And so then you get amplitudes, which are polynomials of degree t, and then you square them to get probabilities, and that makes the polynomial of degree 2t. So by the assumption that the algorithm is correct, this polynomial has to evaluate to some real number from 0 to a third if the function is 1-to-1, right? In other words, it has to say that the function is 2-to-1 with probability at most a third. Whereas if the function is 2-to-1, then it's got to say, well, then it's got to accept the probability greater between 2/3 and 1. And the key insight is that, well, you know, even though this is nowhere mentioned in the statement of the problem, we could also feed the algorithm a 3-to-1 function or a 4-to-1 function or you know some other kinds of functions. And well, whatever it does, whatever the acceptance probability is. You know, if we sort of give it these bad inputs, well, it's got to be between 0 and 1. I hope you believe me. This is generally true of probabilities. So that seems like a trivial observation, but when we look in the world of polynomials, this turns out to be the surprisingly strong constraint. So sort of the key technical step that I do, and I won't go through this, and this was sort of the magic of the proof, I guess. This was sort of the surprising part, is that you can actually transfer from this multilinear polynomial to a univariate polynomial, okay, Q. So the univariate polynomial will have degree at most the degree of the multivariate one. And here's the interpretation of it. It'll take an integer g, and then q of g will be the average of p of x, the expectation of p of x over all g to 1 functions x. Okay. So it's like you feed, you know, so a Q of 1 is the average acceptance probability on a random 1-to-1 function. Q of 2, average acceptance probability on a random 2-to-1 function, random 3-to-1 function, and so on. So we get a univariate polynomial, and what do we know about it? First of all, for all g from 1 up to square root of n, beyond square root of n, things start to break down. I won't go into all the details, but for integer values of g from 0 up to square root of n, polynomial, you know, because it's a representative probability, has to be between 0 and 1. Furthermore, at some point between 1 and 2, some point between 1-to-1 and 2-to-1 functions, it's got to have a large derivative, because it's going from less than 1/3 up to more than 2/3. Okay, well, turns out that mathematicians have studied such polynomials. Okay, and they've said, polynomial is a thing that it doesn't like to stay in a cage. Okay, and what we're doing here is we're putting this polynomial in a very tight cage, and then saying, in addition, it's got to have a large derivative somewhere in that cage. And it turns out there's a classical theorem of Markov from the 1890s that says such a polynomial must have a large degree. You can get that it has to have degree at least n to the 1/5. And from that, it follows that the original quantum algorithm must have made at least n to the 1/5 parts. So that was my first sketch. So you can use this polynomial method to prove other nice things. But for example, so we can consider a generalization of the Grover problem. You know, the problem of finding a marked item. We're now instead of just looking for one item, now we've got k items. Okay, and we want to find all of them. But let's say that we don't even have enough queries to find one of them. Let's say. So intuitively, it seems clear that the probability then that we find all of the items should go down exponentially in k, right? Because it's like, well, you know, there's a small chance we'll find this one. There's also even conditions on that. There's a small chance we'll find the next one, and so on. So this is what in computer science is called a direct product theorem. Okay. But, you know, who knows? These quantum things are strange. Maybe there's some, you know, weird entanglement effect between the different marked items. Okay, so I was able to confirm the intuition that indeed the probability should go down exponentially. My proof again uses the polynomial method. In this case, I needed to use a theorem which was proved not by the famous mathematician A.A. Markov, but by V.A. Markov, who was the lesser known younger brother of A.A. Markov a few years afterward, which deals in, you know, his extension of his older brother's theorem, I guess, dealt not just with the first derivative, but with higher derivatives also. I understand an area of math, you know, when and only when I can use it to prove some complexity results. So I was very happy about that. I can get also as a corollary of this direct product theorem in that oracle or black box setting, the setting sort of that we know how to analyze or where we can prove lower bounds, you can show that NP-complete problems, not only are they not solvable in quantum polynomial time, which was the Bennett-Bernstein-Broussard-Balzerani result, but they're not solvable in quantum polynomial time, even if your quantum computer has a polynomial-sized quantum advice state. Okay, so even if, you know, in the Big Bang, some quantum state was formed, which is just perfect for solving your NP-complete problem, you know, and it's just been sitting around ever since. Right. Except, you know, of course, this state, you know, it depends only on the size of the NP-complete problem you want to solve, right? Not on the particular instance. Otherwise, it would just say, all right, the answer is 1, and, you know, you would just believe it. If you have some quantum advice state, well, you know, even though in some sense you could say a polynomial-sized quantum state encodes sort of an exponential amount of information, you can actually efficiently extract that information in order to, you know, read out the answer to some arbitrary NP-complete problem instance of size n, you know, again, in the black box model or the Oracle model. So, and, you know, in addition, I was able to fix and then even improve on a flawed result of Hart-McCaulk about quantum time-space trade-offs for sorting. It says that if you want to sort numbers with a quantum computer, sort of, you know, the product of the amount of time you need and the number of qubits you need has to be at least some amount.
Okay.
All right. So. So one question we might have, actually, this may be a question a computer scientist would have, you know, before a physicist would, but, you know, all right, all of these quantum lower bounds are nice, but, you know, can we use them to, can we use these ideas to actually prove lower bounds for classical problems? Right, maybe an analogy would be, you know, sometimes a string theorist might try to sort of you know, justify, you know, what they're doing. I think, well, at any rate, you know, you can use these results in conventional quantum field theory, right? You know, it's the same kind of idea, right? To say, well, you know, at any rate, you might not like quantum computing, but you can, you know, can you use it to get new insight into classical computer science? So, you know, I call this a quantum generosity, you know, because we care. Okay. So, all right. So I can, and there were several examples of this, but I'll give you an example in the context of a quantum lower bound. So this problem is called the local search problem. Okay. So now we're given a function that maps n-bit strings to integers, and we're asked. Not you don't have to find the global minimum of the function. Just find any local minimum. Okay, that's all I'm asking for. Just find a local minimum, and again, you get black box access to this function f. You can query it in as much as you like. So all right, here's an example. All right. So at this point, we know that point there is a local minimum. You know, we don't have to query anything else. But in general, even if we just want to find a local minimum, it turns out that classically we might need an exponential number of queries to the function. Because intuitively, you know, there could be just some law, like imagine some enormous like exponential size trail meandering down a mountain. And sort of just wandering, you know, all over, you know, randomly around this high-dimensional space, and then intuitively, you're just going to, you know, if you want to find the unique local minimum, which will be like the end point of this trail, well, you don't have much choice but to just follow this path all the way to the end. And so you need a lot of sort of random walk theory and so forth to formalize that intuition. But David Aldous, a probabilist, you know, managed to do that in 1983 and say that any classical algorithm, you know, even if it can pick which points to query at random, it's got to make at least about 2 to the n over 2 queries to the function to find a local minimum. Okay, so. Okay, so I should mention. So all this is lower bound is close to tight. There is a randomized algorithm that makes about 2 to the n over 2 queries. And also, you know, again, sort of, you know, combining, you know, the idea of just following this path with Grover's algorithm. You know, you see Grover's algorithm is very versatile. You can often just throw it in and, you know, combine it with something else and see what you get. So in this case, you know, as well, you can solve the problem quantumly and only get 2 to the n over 3 time. Okay, so what I was able to show is that, well, not quite, but this is optimal, but that any quantum algorithm to solve this problem has to make at least 2 to the n over 4 queries, or, you know, modulus some low order terms. And if you care about complexity, this gives you, you know, in this Oracle model, there's a complexity class called PLS, Polynomial Local Search, and we can get an Oracle, you know, world where this class is not contained in quantum computing. Okay, but I promised you that this would have some relevance to classical complexity. So the proof technique, as you say, was based on Andras and Bayanis's quantum adversary method. In this method, you imagine feeding your quantum algorithm a superposition over, you know, all of the various possible inputs. And then what you do is you look at so you imagine, all right, you've got your superposition over inputs, and now you've got your algorithm, and now you look at just the reduced state of the input part, right? And you look at the density matrix of this part of the state. And then you say, all right, well, in order for the algorithm to succeed, it would have to separate the zero inputs from the one inputs, which means that these off-diagonal terms should go to zero, right? They should, in other words, you've got to create entanglement between the input and the algorithm registers, right? But then you can say, well, but each query can only increase the amount of entanglement by so much. Measured by how much these off diagonal terms decrease, and so you bound how long it takes. And so what I was able to do is to give a classical analog of Bayanis's quantum adversary method that actually gave a new and simpler proof of Aldous's lower bound in the classical case. And actually a tighter result than he was able to get. And also I was able to apply this to constant dimensional grid graphs. So instead of the hypercube, just a grid of two or three dimensions, let's say. And this technique gave something for that. So these results were soon after were generalized to all graphs by Mikko Santa and Mario Segedi. And then recently they were also tightened in many cases by Sheng Yu Zhang. All right, so summary of this part, this was so we had these two methods, polynomials and adversary methods. We can even apply this technique classically. So I mean, we have, you know, I think it's sort of it evolved into an art form. We have pretty powerful techniques. We've also seen that quantum computing is not a panacea. There, you know, even if we had quantum computers around, there'd be many problems that would still be intractable. And this is true even with quantum advice. And one thing that, you know, I think a lot of popular articles get wrong is quantum computing is not the same as exponential parallelism. The way I would describe it is that because of linearity, sort of one parallel universe can't, you know, shout above the others and say, well, here I am, you know, here's the solution. And, it takes time for that sort of branch to influence all the others. That's just how I think about it. Okay, so, let me talk about sort of the models and reality, some of the more, further out types of results. So first, a question that we might ask is, even though, you know, we've seen that, you know, quantum computers have some limitations, but, you know, they also have these strengths, like factoring enormous integers very quickly. And, you know, is this just inherently ridiculous? Is this just this obvious baloney? And there are actually a fair number of computer scientists who think that the answer is yes. Who think, you know, well, if this is what quantum mechanics says, then so much the worse for quantum mechanics. Of course, they don't suggest any alternative, but, you know, it's obvious to them that, you know, there must be some because nature, you know, couldn't possibly provide the capability to solve these kinds of problems. Leonard Levin, one of the founders of event incompleteness theory, is, well, you know, we've never seen a physical law valid to over a dozen decimals. These, you know, quantum amplitudes would have to be accurate to, you know, hundreds of, you know, thousands of decimal places, right? And then, you know, so, you know, clearly, you know, some other physics is going to take over, which, you know, of course, you know, a priori we know is not going to let us solve these problems efficiently. That Galbraith, you know, has argued that, well, you know, basically, you know, his view of quantum computing model consists of exponentially long vectors. And if you have an exponentially long vector, then somehow, you know, it's going to take exponential time to manipulate. And so these are the kinds of arguments that, you know, to deal with in computer science. Of course, you know, there are also physicists, such things like Gerard de Hooft. So I had a paper a couple of years ago where I tried to make the argument over this question a little bit more precise with a notion which I called a shore-shore separator. Okay, and so my question is just, all right, well, what is the criteria that separates the quantum states that we're sure we can create, you know, that have already been observed in the lab or whatever, from these states that would suffice for Peter Shor's factoring algorithm? You know, if you believe that quantum mechanics is going to break down before it, you know, it becomes possible to create this kind of states that you see in Shor's algorithm, well, then clearly there must be such a separator. So where is it? You know, where do you draw the line? You know, beyond which, if you try to create states beyond that line, then quantum mechanics will break down. You know, give me a plausible separator. Okay. So to get some intuition about this question, I should point out, such a separator, you know, it can't be exponentially small amplitudes. I mean, just take, you know, 10,000 photons and polarize them all at 45 degrees, and you've got exponentially small amplitudes, okay? Nor can it be the number of qubits that would be maintained in coherent superposition, because, you know, we have seen fairly large cat states in experiments, like for example, you know, I guess the Zeilinger group's buckyball experiments, or these experiments involving superconducting coils, and, well, anyway, you know, many of you know more about it than I do. Okay, so in this paper, what I did is I proposed that we, you know, as a first step toward answering this question, that we just try to classify different, you know, quantum states by their complexity. So now, you know, I'm not looking at what problems you can solve with the help of quantum states. I'm just looking at the quantum states themselves. And saying, you know, how can we characterize their complexity? And so a particular notion that I looked at is something I call tree size. And basically, this measure is just, if you were to write down the quantum state on a piece of paper, so then, you know, you're only allowed to use, like, plus signs and, you know, tensor product signs and, so, you know, in cats and amplitudes, right? How much paper do you need? Okay, that's basically the measure. I mean, so you imagine that your quantum state is represented by a tree, where, you know, at any point you can sort of take a linear combination of two states that you've already created, or you can take a tensor product of two states you've already created, right? And you start with just qubits. You start with a 0 and 1. And the question is, what is the minimum size of such a tree that would represent your quantum state? This is the measure that I call the tree size of quantum states. And my motivation was, well, all right, this is at least one possibility for such a separator. Because it does seem like all the states they've been able to create, including the examples I showed before, with the 0 plus 1 over root 2 tensored n times, the Schrodinger cat states, right? These all have small tree size. They might have a lot of entanglement, but they have a very, very small tree complexity. So maybe we could show that the states that arise in Shor's algorithm would have a large tree complexity. Okay, so I actually, well, I am able to show that, but only modulo a number theoretic conjecture, which I don't know how to prove, but which is true. Where I can actually prove it with no conjecture is for the kind of states that would arise in quantum error correction. Okay, a random stabilizer state, if you know what that is. I can prove that if you have such a state, it is with high probability, it is not expressible by any tree of linear combinations and tensor products of polynomial size. I can't show that you need exponentially many, but I can show that you need at least n to the log n power. Or actually, I think like n to the log n over 100,000 power. But, you know, it's constant. So, and this sort of applied a very recent breakthrough result in classical theoretical computer science, which was a lower bound on multilinear formula size due to Ron Ross.
Scott?
Yeah.
So is that, if you wanted to do it, it represents, say, exactly or approximately?
Even if you want to do it approximately, still the same lower bound holds.
Great.
Like if you want to get within, you know, if you want the inner product to be at most a third. Yeah. Okay. So. So another question I had sort of about the model is, you know, are in some sense are quantum states really exponential sized objects? Well, that's a very vague question. But you know, one way to make it precise is to ask about their how powerful they are in communication protocols. So all right, we've got Alice and Bob. Who we know very well, and so it's the setting I'll imagine is that Bob wants to compute some function f, Alice has a string x and Bob has a string y, and this is a function jointly of their two inputs together, and in order to you know, let Bob compute this function, well, Alice can send him a message, but she can, in fact, send him a quantum message, which depends on x. What we're interested in is how long does this quantum message have to be? How many qubits does this message have to be to enable Bob to compute the function for any x-y pair? Right. Okay, and I can prove a general result, which is that equation there. Let me explain to you what the things mean. What it means is given any if Alice's string x is n bits long, Bob's string y is m bits long. So then, you know, we'll denote by d1 of f. That's the deterministic one-way communication complexity. So if Alice could just send Bob a deterministic classical message, that's how many bits she would have to send. Okay, Q1F is the quantum one-way complexity. That's, you know, in, you know, how many bits if she has to send a quantum message. And what I can prove is that if Bob's input is small, so sort of if the number of measurements that Bob might, number of different measurements that Bob might want to make on the quantum state that Alice sends to him is not that great, then you can always take the quantum message and you can replace it by a classical message, which is not that much larger.
Okay.
That's what this result says. So you know, if m is small, then these two measures, the deterministic and the quantum communication complexity, are very close to each other. Okay, you know, they differ by only a small factor. Okay, I can get a corollary of this in computational complexity, which is I mentioned before this class BQP/QPoly. Which is what you can do in the problems you can solve efficiently on a quantum computer if you've got some quantum advice, some quantum state that's designed to optimally sort of help you solve your problem that, you know, could have been created in the Big Bang and was sitting around ever since. And, you know, you find such a state and use it to try to help you solve your problem, even though you couldn't prepare the state yourself in any reasonable amount of time. Okay, what I can show is I can show a limit on the power of such advice, which is that anything you could solve efficiently with the help of such a quantum advice, but you could also solve with classical advice. You could also solve with a polynomial-sized classical advice string, provided that you're able to post-select the outcome of your computation. Okay, provided that you're, you know, you're able to make a measurement and then just assume that the outcome's going to be one. Just discard all runs of your computation where the outcome of that measurement would be zero. Or, you know, alternatively, just use exponentially more computation time to sort of extract what the advice is trying to tell you. But in any case, what this says is that the quantum advice is not, you know, in some sense, infinitely more powerful than classical advice. It's only exponentially more powerful. Okay, so just have a few more things. How much should I?
How much longer do you got?
I've got a few more slides. So.
Well, take 5 minutes by all means. We should have a little time for questions.
Okay. All right. Sorry. So let's say we have a quantum robot which is trying to search some physical region. It can go into a superposition over the different locations, but it takes time to move around. Okay, to move from one place to another takes from one grid place to an adjacent one takes unit time. But we can go in superposition. We want to find the marked item. So Paul Benioff had a paper where he pointed out, well, we could run Grover's algorithm, but each of the square root of n iterations takes square root of n time, you know, just to move all of the quantum amplitude across the grid and back. So the total time will just be n. So it's no improvement over the classical case. But he just stated this. So I wanted to prove it as a lower bound. So I worked on it and jointly with Andres and Bias. And sadly, we were unable to prove a lower bound. But we did the next best thing, which is we proved the impossibility of proving a lower bound. Or in other words, we gave an algorithm. So we showed that actually you can do something more and more clever than just the bare Grover's algorithm that lets you search a two-dimensional grid in square root of n time with some logarithmic term, or just in plain square root of n time in for grids of three or higher dimensions. And there's a corollary that I want to talk about. My motivation, for studying this question was sort of what computational limitations are imposed by the speed of light being finite. Sort of, we've talked about what limitations are imposed by the linearity of quantum mechanics, but what about if you combine quantum linearity with the fact that moving from one bit to another in a physical database takes unit time. Well, and what this shows is sort of the two limitations combined are not really that much more than just one of the limitations. At least if the database that you're searching is in two or more dimensions. If it's a one dimensional database, then clearly you need n steps just to get from one end of it to the other end. Okay. So there is, of course, a foolproof way to solve NP-complete problems efficiently, and that's just guess a random solution. If it's wrong, kill yourself. Post-selection remaining alive, like that. So I was interested in the question: what is the class of problems efficiently solvable in this model of computation? So I said, that this class post BQP, which is not like postmodern, but it is a post-selected quantum polynomial time. It's the class of problems that you can solve that way, and I was able to characterize this class as being exactly equal to a classical complexity class, which is called PP, probabilistic polynomial time, which is actually believed to be a much larger class than just NP. So it seemed like you could do a lot more than just solve NP complete problems if you have this power of post-selection sort of combined with quantum computation. And as a corollary, there are numerous sort of small changes to quantum mechanics that if you make them, you could solve PP-complete problems efficiently. So for example, if you allowed a non-unitary but still linear transformations, or if you change the measurement rule from like psi squared to psi cubed, or psi to sort of any other power actually, but with suitable normalization. Okay. Yeah.
We do have non-unitary transformations.
Oh yeah, but they're unitary transformations in a larger Hilbert space, so they don't count. So, I mean, seriously, badly non-unitary. So, okay.
Non-CP maps.
Yeah. fine. So, okay, but you know, all right, so I think, you know, computer scientists, you know, will sort of look at this and say, all right, you know, you're just, you know, talking about, you know, some weird philosophical thing to sort of make jokes about in talks, but, sure, you know, when I was just writing this you know, little result up in my thesis, I noticed something, which is that it immediately implies one of, you know, the sort of celebrated results of classical computational complexity theory, which was sort of an open problem since the 1970s, was finally solved in the 90s by Beagle, Reingold, and Spielman. And this was to show that the complexity class PP is closed under intersection. In other words, that if you've got two languages that are both in PP, then the intersection of those languages is also in PP. And you know, they use the sort of threshold polynomials. You know, they use sort of very high powered techniques to solve this. The thing is, post BQP, it's very, very easy to see it's closed under intersection, because if you've got you know, two problems where you can just sort of run, you know, solve both of them, post select on both of them succeeding, and then take the end of the two, you know, take the logical end of the two outcomes. Right, and so I'm staring at this. I'm like, wait a minute, there must be something wrong. You know, it was equal post-BQP. It's closed under intersection, but you know, this actually does provide a much simpler proof of the Beagle-Reingold Spielman theorem. So this is another sort of feedback from quantum computing back to classical computer science. All right, so I have this thing about hidden variables, which I actually did talk about at Perimeter a couple of years ago, about the power, you know, what problems you could solve efficiently if you could sample the entire history of a hidden variable through a quantum computer, and some evidence that you could do even more than, you know, you could do with a garden variety quantum computer, such a model, but not so much more that you could solve it for complete problems. All right, so I have, so this is my model of hidden variable computing, and I'm going to actually skip past this because I'm low on time. All right, so I just had a few slides about what am I working on lately. This was all sort of older stuff. So one thing I'm working on is sort of quantum versus classical proofs. So there's a class called QMA, which is this sort of the quantum version of NP. It's the class of problems where if the answer is yes, I can give you a polynomial-sized quantum state that lets you verify that the answer is yes by making suitable measurements on that state efficiently. Okay, well then we can also, you know, this is what complexity is like. We, you know, we define a new class, okay? We can consider a class called QCMA, Quantum Classical MA, which is the same thing, but now as QMA, but now we've got a quantum computer that has to verify a classical proof, okay? So the verification is still quantum, but now the proof is classical. And the question is, you know, do you actually gain anything by letting the proof be your quantum state? You know, does that actually give you more power? So in other words, the question is QMA equal to QCMA, okay? And as usual, big surprise, the answer is we don't know, okay? You know, we, you know, presume that they're not equal, but we don't know, okay? So in recent joint work with Greg Cooperberg, we were able to get a sort of, you know, I'd say like the first formal complexity theoretic evidence that they're not equal, and it's actually a new form of evidence. It's something we call quantum oracle separation. Okay, remember when you prove an oracle separation, you say if the two classes were both able to solve some problem, you know, then like for free or at unit cost, then the classes would be different. Here,
what is QMA?
Oh, QMA is a quantum MA.
I guess what is MA?
Yeah, okay. MA, all right. Well, I wasn't going to go into it. It stands for Merlin Arthur. But it's, all right. Basically, MA is just a probabilistic version of NP. That's all it is. Okay. So QMA, just a class of problems where, you know, if the answer is yes, there exists a quantum state I can give you such that, you know, you'll answer yes with probability at least 2/3. If the answer is no, then no quantum state I could give you would cause you to answer yes with probability more than 1/3. Okay. And your quantum polynomial time. Yeah. That's the definition. So what we can show is, so we have to sort of generalize the notion of an orbital separation, what we call quantum orbital separation. We can say that if the QMA machine and the QCMA machine both had some n-qubit unitary transformation, which might be very complicated, but which they can both apply for free, then in that setting, the QMA machine would be more powerful. Okay. And you know, we can prove this. So what that means, you know, or sort of the upshot of such results is that if QMA were equal to QCMA, you know, or if you could always replace the quantum proofs by classical proofs, then that at least would be very, very hard to prove. Okay, because the proof would have to sort of be sensitive to the fact that there was, you know, that there was not such an oracle around, that there was not such a unitary around, and usually the kind of proofs that we can do in complexity are not sensitive to that kind of information. Okay, so at least, you know, if quantum proofs are no more powerful than classical proofs, then that will be very hard to prove. Okay, so all right, and then I can also, all right, so I talked about quantum advice, I talked about quantum proofs, and a recent paper I looked at, what if you combine them? Okay, then, you know, does this give you a, you know, like sort of unlimited computational power? And I can show this actually turned out to be much harder than, you know, analyzing either of them alone. But, you know, with some new tools, I was able to show, no, you still don't get infinite power. Anything you could solve with both a quantum proof, polynomial-sized quantum proof, and polynomial-sized quantum advice, you could also solve using polynomial-sized classical advice if you have classical polynomial memory, maybe exponential time. Okay. All right, so these things are getting a little bit more abstract to state what they are. So, all right, so this is my current work, the things that I've sort of done but haven't written up yet. So I'm thinking about quantum, so copy protection of quantum software, making quantum programs that you can use to evaluate some function such that you can't use it to produce like two programs that would both evaluate that same function. Maybe Microsoft would, you know, buy the patent for it, I don't know. So quantum software obfuscation, you know, having a program which is a quantum state, which, you know, sort of you can't reverse engineer to sort of see its source code, because if you did, you would measure it and destroy it. But, you know, such that, you could still use the state to solve the computational problem you care about. Okay, and so learning of quantum states, sort of a quantum Occam's razor theorem. I'll skip past that. Quantum polynomial time with closed time-like curves. We imagine, all right, you've got a closed time-like curve, and you've got some qubits that go sort of around this curve, and we say that, okay, whatever. Whatever super operator is acting sort of around this curve, the nature has to pick like a density matrix, you know, for the state like within that curve, which is a fixed point of the super operator, right? This is called the causal consistency condition. This is like to avoid grandfather paradoxes, basically. The question is, you know, if such, you know, strange things were around in nature, what kind of computational power would that give you? And it's clear right away that it gives you a lot of computational power, because you can create like a quantum circuit such that finding a fixed point of that circuit, you know, is itself a very hard problem, right? Or like standard, I mean, you can just describe it in terms of a science fiction novel that, you know, someone goes, you know, into the future and then, you know, invents some great technology and goes back in time and gives it to you, and then how did it ever get invented in the first place, right? Well, because someone in the future did it, but how did they have it? Well, because someone in the past, you know, right? And, you know, so, all right, so you just translate that to the computational setting, and what you can get with some work is that you can do, you can solve at least the p-space problems. You can, you know, at least what you could do classically in polynomial space, you can do in such a model of closed time-like curves. there was a question whether you could do even more than that. And so jointly with John Watchers, I think we've answered that question negatively. What you can do in this model is exactly what you could do in the grad school program in space.
What's the BDP with something like this?
Also piece of space. So in other words, you know, adding, you know, having a quantum computer, you know, does not give you any more power if you've got closed time like Earth around. there's no additional quantum. Okay. So all right. So concluding remarks. I think there's this ogre of intractability that sort of menaces the world of computation, and I think not even quantum computers escape. Except maybe, in a few specific instances. And, we've seen sort of, I think, a variety of evidence for that. We've seen sort of quantum lower bound techniques that, are unreasonably effective in some sense. They work, even sort of, beyond what where they're supposed to work, right? They even work to give, new lower bounds in classical computer science, okay? So my challenge for quantum computing skeptics, give us a better picture of the world. Like, give us a picture of the world, that would recover the experiments that have been done and the quantum states that have been prepared, but in which large-scale quantum computing is still impossible. And I talked about, what such a picture might look like. But of course, if skeptics don't like my picture, they can come up with a better one. So computer science and fundamental physics match made in Hilbert space. I think it's a perspective that sort of forces us to take quantum mechanics very seriously instead of sweeping it under the rug. Maybe I'm preaching to the choir here. We can get insights. Okay, I didn't talk about all of this stuff here, but I at least talked about post-selection. Could there be computational input to quantum gravity? Could we take ought we to take the intractability, let's say, anti-complete problems as an axiom of physics, similar to the impossibility of superliminal signaling or the second law of thermodynamics? If we were to do so, does it have useful consequences, or is that useful in the search for physical theories? All right, these are just questions. I'm not answering them. So if you want to read up on any of this, you can go to the archive, or that's my homepage. So that's it. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, listening to your talk, quite nice things, but I got the feeling that computer scientists are very much like their neighbors, mathematicians, in that they have to convert everything into their own language. And I wasn't referring to the algorithm, to the acronyms, which I have to say I find a bit daunting. But when you look at the computer scientist skeptics, it seemed to me that the questions they were asking were very different from the physicist skeptics who were worried about experimental practicability, in the sense that they were trying to convert this into their own language, talking about exponentially long vectors and things, and missing the whole point. And
I can say, first of all, there are.
And I was wondering, particularly, I always think about the limitations in terms of the Halevi-Baum accessible information, which basically says that the measurement is restricting you, and I didn't see that playing a role in your responses.
Okay. All right. So there's several things there, but the Halevi-Baum, is definitely related, but for the kind of problems that I was talking about, it's not enough. Right, you need sort of something stronger than that, because you need not only, can you not pack, I didn't have time, or else I would have talked about that explicitly, but you need not only can you not pack n classical bits into fewer than n qubits and read all of them out, but even if you just wanted to read one of them out, or even if you just wanted the answer to some one communication complexity problem, that this is that still isn't hard, right? So it moves toward the random access coding lower bound of bias at all, and then sort of I would call them, you know, post-Halevo type, you know, results. But so there are physicists who criticize quantum computing, you know, on practical grounds, and I have no beef with them, you know. Okay, they say that maybe we'll build a quantum computer for a million years, and the practical obstacles are daunting, and I say, you know, hey, you know. Or, you know, so for all I know, you're right. Okay.
A million years is a constant.
So. What? Yeah, a million years is indeed a constant. if they said 2 to the n years, then I would have something to argue about. But, So I did mention like Gerard and Hoof, you know, I mean, all right, I guess Wolfram would be another example, but yeah, all right, it doesn't count, but I do it then. So there are physicists, you know, who do believe that, you know, quantum computing is an unreasonable model, and, you know, say that quite explicitly, that they think that quantum mechanics is going to break down, and then, you know, like, the question, of course, is what replaces it. With regard to the acronyms, you know, I think you could sort of see the reason for them in the talk. Whenever I tried to state a result, you know, whenever I tried to expand out what it meant, I would run out of breath before I finished. Okay, so that's the reason for the acronyms, because, you know, they let us express sort of, you know, what would otherwise be sort of very complicated things, you know, and just like, you know, QMA is contained in PP. That's all you have to say. I guess, you know, you're kind of like the prisoners who like to tell jokes by calling out their code numbers or something. But, you know, if you know the code numbers, it's quite funny. So. Yeah.
Is it possible to conceive of these computations with both timeline curves as at least some thought experiment fantasy level that one could actually build a quantum computing device, like if you build a time machine or something, or like how does one?
Well, yeah, presumably if you could build a time machine, then, you know, and you were wondering what model of computation would apply to it, I guess it would be this one. But, so, you know, I mean, you know, if you want, you know, my real opinion, I mean, I would take it as just an additional form of evidence, you know, beyond the evidence that would come from, you know, the sort of, you know, all of the other issues that are caused with, you know, non-linearities and quantum mechanics and, you know, and all the other things that would break down. It's just an additional piece of evidence that these are unphysical objects.
But that's using a specific Deutsch model.
Yes, it is. So, you know, I mean, if there's another model which is sort of well-defined enough to come up with a model of computation, I'll study that one as well.
Yeah, well, actually, yeah. I think you already have. I think you could do post-BQP, which would also be an agreement.
Is that a really, really close time-like curve?
Yeah, have you ever heard this talk by Bennett or Schumacher?
Okay, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, but okay, but I'm interested in sort of the most general thing you could do. I mean, clearly you could do at least post-BQP.
Well, no, but I mean, so they were not talking about, you know, using this to describe actual dynamics in both time like curves, but you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, it would be the appropriate model system.
Okay.
Any more questions? Thanks.